A-V-V-V-R-R-R-X-X-X. KVRX.
Ever wonder if you can use statistics to model the zombie outbreak?
Or what kind of creatures evolve in an Antarctic climate?
Or how forensic epidemiologists determine the cause of a deadly disease outbreak?
Then tune in to They Blinded Me with Science every Monday night from 8:30 to 9 on KVRX Austin, where we discuss news from all across the sciences.
Since 2007, we've featured interviews with a diverse array of researchers, from up-and-coming young scientists to noted luminaries, as well as roundtable discussions of exciting new scientific developments.
Join us Monday evenings, 8:30 to 9 p.m. for your weekly dose of science on KVRX 91.7. Good evening. It is now time for They Blinded Me with Science, and it's about 8:30, and you're listening to KVRX 91.7 in Austin, Texas. I'm DJ Arnott.
This is DJ G Rex.
I'm DJ Gendrite.
And we are joined by a special guest tonight. This is my friend and colleague, Dr. Jeff Silverman. And Dr. Jeff Silverman's more or less bounced back and forth between California and Texas. He went to high school in California, where he was part of a science Olympiad. We'll hear maybe a little bit more about that later. Then got his undergraduate degree at Rice University, went back to California for his PhD at UCal Berkeley, and now is a NSF postdoctoral research fellow at the University of Texas at Austin Department of Astronomy. And we're delighted to welcome Jeff here tonight. Hello, Jeff.
Hi there. Thank you, guys.
So, just to get things started, we'd like to just hear how you got started in astronomy in general and sort of what your path was. We've heard already that you've gone back and forth from California and Texas, but what was sort of your intellectual or academic interest in astronomy, and how did it grow over time?
I really, as long as I can remember, loved the stars, loved the beauty of the night sky. Even growing up in suburban Southern California, you know, I would go outside, look at the moon, see the stars. My mom says ever since I was 6 years old, I liked going to the planetariums and the science museums. And, you know, luckily my parents were great and fostered that, and I would always check out the same astronomy book from the elementary school library every week. And, you know, it sort of grew, and sort of learned a lot in high school and picked up some books along the way and sort of taught myself some basic astronomy. Took a lot of physics and math classes, computer science classes, you know, that kind of standard stuff. And that sort of just love for the science, love for the field of astronomy and the beauty of it sort of carried through, along with learning the nuts and bolts details of, you know, the math equations and the hardcore physics behind it. And that's basically what I've been doing in undergrad, grad school, and now postdoc research at UT.
Cool. That's great. Yeah, I saw that you were a Science Olympiad winner. What is it? You're, within your high school, were you all national champs? Is that right? Or state champs? Or what was that?
So Troy High School in Fullerton, California, for any of those listening at home, pretty solid Science Olympiad powerhouse, if I do say so myself. We were state champions many, many years running. I got to go to nationals with the team in 2001, my senior year of high school. And at nationals, I participated in the astronomy, the Reach for the Stars event. And with my partner, Tejas Patel, we won it. So I've got a gold medal from National Science Olympiad, one of my prized possessions at home.
Wow, that's great. And now full-fledged PhD scientist here at UT Austin. And you're doing great things. And we'd like to hear about some of that. I guess maybe let's just go ahead and talk about supernovae. So what you do research on is supernovae, and in general in astronomy, you can't just go and visit an object to you know, study it in detail by getting a sample of it and bringing it to a lab. That's typically inaccessible in astronomy compared to the other sciences. So could you describe to us what are some of your approaches and techniques that you can use to study the objects that you're going to study, and then we can talk about some of the objects themselves.
Yeah, you bring up a great point that astronomy is really unique in that aspect. We can't go into a lab, you know, but take a measurement, turn a knob, slightly vary something, take another measurement, and so the way that a lot of people do their astronomy research. And what I really utilized for a lot of my research is large samples. If you just stare at the universe, you look up in the sky, and in my case, look for a new star that has now exploded. It's ended its life in this massive, very powerful, energetic explosion known as a supernova. And if you look hard enough and you're very careful and you have sensitive enough telescopes that are looking often enough, you can find a few of these exploding stars each night. And then, you know, some are more interesting than others, and you can follow them up with other telescopes and, you know, part of big collaborations around the world where you kind of pool your resources and you can build up these large samples. My PhD thesis was a few hundred of these exploding stars that we got thousands of observations of. And then once you have that, you can start to do some real statistical analysis. You can say, okay, the typical supernova looks like this, and this one is weird because of this or that, and how weird is it? How many sigma for the scientists out there?
So you said you're collecting multiple of these a night sometimes. Do astronomers have sort of an estimate of how often these sort of things occur?
Yeah, the number we like to throw around is in the entire universe, we think a star explodes about once a second.
Wow.
So most of these are much too far away that we'll never see them. They're too faint, too far away. We're just not going to see them. Sort of in the mid to late 90s, we started getting these robotic automated telescopes that would, you know, have weather sensors. If it's clear, it opens up. It looks at a bunch of different galaxies every night, tries to find new supernova. And those are finding a supernova every few days. Also, amateur astronomers around the world, little backyard telescopes in really dark sites, people who have memorized what galaxies look like in detail, actually have found, at that time, almost as many supernova as the professionals. So wow. It's a really great combination of the amateurs and the professionals. In the past 10 years or so, 10 to 15 years, we have these very large collaborations, international collaborations, you know, bigger telescopes, more looking fainter, more detailed observations. Detectors, basically digital cameras, are getting more sensitive, and you can build them bigger for cheaper. And that's really revolutionized supernova discoveries. And you really can find, you know, a few a day, even to dozens a day if you get lucky, or per night, I guess I should say.
Cool. Well, I guess I want to hear a little bit more about when you say you say that some supernovae are more interesting than others, and you can sort of describe a typical supernova. So supernovae, A-E ending is the plural of supernova, singular.
For all the Latin majors out there, we know this is a bastardization, but it's sort of been in the lingo for a while now.
Yeah, so anyways, we have this terminology to describe collections of these objects, and you said part of your work was to characterize hundreds of these. So tell us a little bit more about the formation, or not formation, but the cause of these explosions in a typical case, and then we can find out and hear a little bit more about what the unusual ones are doing.
Yeah, so there's two main ways to get a supernova, a star to explode, and those really make up the bulk of the population. So one way is you have a pretty massive star, something that's maybe 8 or 10 times more massive than the sun. It goes through its life, it does nuclear fusion in its core, and eventually it builds up heavier and heavier elements till you get up to iron. So you have this big ball of iron in the middle of this star, and you can't do iron fusion. That doesn't give off energy. And so the iron just kind of sits there, and it's not producing new energy. So you're not producing energy in the middle of the star. You don't have anything pushing out on the outer layers of the star. But there's all these outer layers that are still squishing down on that iron core, and gravity's pulling it inward. And so you now have an imbalance. And this imbalance leads to a collapse of the star. The outer layers hit this iron core. Some nuclear magic happens, and then you get a big explosion. And that nuclear magic really is not well understood at this point. So that's one way to get a supernova. A massive star at the end of its life collapses and then explodes outward. The other way to get your typical star that explodes, your typical supernova, is near and dear to my heart. It's what I've specialized in for the most part over the years. And this is where you have a very compact dead remnant star called a white dwarf. So the sun in a few billion years will turn into a white dwarf. But what's key to make a supernova out of a white dwarf is that white dwarf needs a partner. So the sun's a lonely star, chilling on its own, it's not going to go supernova. But if a white dwarf has a partner that's nearby, that white dwarf can actually steal some material from its partner. And if it steals enough material, white dwarfs have a maximum size. They can only be about 1.4 times as big as the sun. And after that, nuclear physics says that it can't hold itself up, it's got to collapse, and actually that collapse turns into a thermonuclear runaway. So you're setting off a hydrogen bomb. Really, it's carbon and oxygen. So you're setting off a carbon and oxygen bomb that's the size of the sun, or weighs as much as 1.4 times the mass of the sun. So this is hugely powerful, gigantic explosion, and this is how we get the other main kind of supernova.
Right.
So your research focuses mainly on describing these certain situations or specials like supernovae, or I guess they're not necessarily special, but like the less common ones. So do you do any, like, I guess what I'm trying to ask is, like, how do you go about describing them? Like, what kind of tools do you use? And do you run any sort of experiments? Or it's basically like, it looks like this and it has these properties.
So I'm definitely in the latter camp on that. Okay. But there's many people, especially at UT, in the former. So I'll talk a little bit about both. Most of what I do is, we discover these supernovae with various, mostly robotic telescopes, some amateur astronomers. And then I use other telescopes to follow it up and try and figure out the details of how bright does it get, how much energy is in there, what's the temperature, what elements did it make, how fast is the exploding material leaving the site of the explosion. And then using those observable characteristics, I try to classify things, put them into little boxes, and then hopefully those boxes can tell us a little bit more about, you know, if you noticed carefully, when I said the white dwarf was stealing material from a partner, I was real vague about what that partner was. Mm-hmm. And that's because we think that there's a lot of different possibilities. Is it another white dwarf? Is it a sun-like star? Is it a big puffed up red giant star? It's not totally clear, and we might have multiple channels to make these things. And we think by measuring, you know, energies and elements that are created and how fast the material is moving, that we might be able to get at that question of, you know, what exactly the conditions are, what kind of star is going off, etc. On the experimental side, a lot of people at UT are using the Texas supercomputing clusters to basically model an exploding star in the computer. Put in all the physics equations we know, put in other recipes for nuclear physics and gravity and energy, and then let it go and see if we can recreate the conditions that blew up a star. And then you can sort of step back from that and say, okay, if I were an observer on Earth looking at that explosion in the computer, what would it look like? And then my collaborators can show me that, and I can compare it to what I actually see in nature, and hopefully they match. And if they don't, well, I saw it in nature, so that clearly their computer model's wrong.
I noticed looking through your publications that it'll say type blah, 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 supernovae. So how many different types are there? I know you said that there's two general types of supernovae, but, like, what does 1B or 1A mean, or...
Well, you've asked a very sensitive question to a lot of supernova observers. Depending on who you talk to, there could be anywhere from, I would say, 30 to 50 sub-subtypes of supernovae. I described in general the two main ones, the type 2s, which come from the very massive stars that collapse on themselves, and the type 1As, which are these little white dwarfs that steal material and explode. The type 2s can be of various flavors depending on what that massive star exactly was before it collapses on itself, what its outer layers are made of, how massive it actually was. Similarly, on the 1A side, again, I said that depending on what the partner star that the white dwarf steals material from can affect things. We think the surrounding environment of that white dwarf. Is there a lot of dust and junk and, you know, carbonaceous dust sitting around that supernova? Or is it very clean? Was it a very old environment and things have gotten swept out? And depending on, you know, how the explosion starts, how the explosion proceeds even through the star, internal to this star that explodes, we think can have a huge impact on what we see as observers, and then we name them different types.
So there's a lot of disagreement among people who have expertise in this area, or are there people who characterize a supernova as one particular type, and then other people go back and study it, and they say, no, it's this type, and then there's conflict?
There are reclassifications on occasion. That's certainly true. As observations have gotten better, telescopes have gotten bigger, detectors have gotten more sensitive, we've realized that there is this diversity, that when the observations weren't as good, we just didn't notice these subtle differences. And so you almost might expect with time to get a finer and finer subtyping ability with better observations. So, you know, that I think makes sense. Where the argument and disagreement comes from is, you know, are these things really different, or is there one thing that I can change that really can connect a lot of stuff? You know, there are certain type 1a supernova that are much brighter than others. But is that just a matter of, well, maybe there's just a little bit extra material and or a little less material, and it's really the same thing. I'm just tweaking one little knob in the lab, basically. And there's a lot of disagreement and ongoing research on, can I connect some of these disparate subtypes by just changing which angle we're looking at? Maybe all this dust and junk that I said might be around stuff is confined to a very thin plane. And if you look through that plane, perhaps that's when you see this very dusty supernova. But when you're looking above the plane, you don't actually see that dusty material, and then you would call it a very normal type 1a supernova. So trying to unite some of these models, some of these subtypes using the models, is definitely a very active area of research.
There's one special property, actually, I wanted to mention about the type 1As that I'm aware of and actually has received some attention from enough attention to garner a Nobel Prize in the last couple of years. And so this property is sort of slightly contradicting what you just said, but you can clarify for us, which is that apparently supernova type 1As are so homogeneous in their intrinsic brightness, so in their intrinsic luminosity, that we could actually use them as what astronomers call standard candles. So we know the brightness of something, and so therefore we can relate its distance by its perceived or apparent brightness. And so I'd like to ask you about this specifically. Is that true? Are all supernova type 1As homogeneous enough in brightness that we can use them as standard candles?
That's a great question, and I have a lot of friends that read, you know, pop science articles in and out of astronomy that have asked me this question exactly when I mention things like some can be brighter or fainter. And it seems that the bulk of type 1a supernova are very similar in a lot of ways, but there is a range of this luminosity, the internal amount of energy or brightness. And so they're not standard candles, but we can correct for that. So we call them standardizable candles, if you want to get the technical lingo these days. And so what that means is, sure, there are some type 1a supernova that are a little bit brighter than others, but based on how fast they get bright and how fast they fade away, we can actually correct for their slight overbrightness. And similar for ones that are a little bit underluminous. They're not quite as energetic as some of the typical 1As. Again, they tend to actually rise to maximum brightness pretty quick and fade away pretty quick. And so by using how fast it rises and falls in brightness, we can actually standardize the luminosity. And then once you've done that, then you've got a very homogeneous set. Then you've got a bunch of 100-watt light bulbs. If you put a 100-watt light bulb really far away, it looks faint. And if you put a 100-watt light bulb really close, it looks really bright. And so by how bright it appears, like you said, the apparent luminosity, the apparent brightness, then we can scale to the distance. And that way, we got very accurate distances to a lot of these type 1a supernovas over the past couple decades.
Cool. So tell us, and I know one of our co-hosts is averse to the whole concept that I'm about to discuss.
I'm not averse to it. I'm frightened by it.
She's downright frightened by the prospect of what we're about to discuss. But what we're about to discuss is dark energy. And so tell us, what is dark energy?
Well, dark energy makes up 75% of all the mass and energy in the universe.
So, what's the other 25%?
So the other 25%, most of that, about 22-ish%, is dark matter, which is very different than dark energy, except for the word dark, which I'll mention a little bit about in a second. And then that last remaining few percent is what we normally think of, electrons and protons and helium and hydrogen and dogs and cats and people and planets.
Yeah, the stuff we're made out of, basically.
Right. So the
what fraction is you?
So what fraction is... I've never calculated that. I should at some point, but very, very small, sadly.
Very small fraction.
So the bulk of the matter in the universe and energy in the universe is this dark matter and dark energy. The only thing that relates the two is the word dark, which, pro tip for everyone out there, dark in astronomy lingo just means we don't know what the heck it actually is. So there's a lot of open questions on that. So dark energy was first discovered or first proposed by some of these supernova observations in the late 90s. We got the distances very accurately to a lot of these type 1a supernova. And since the 1920s, we knew that the universe was expanding. All galaxies are moving away from each other. And so we had this idea, it seemed to make sense, and for a long time people thought that this expansion of the universe was going to slow down. Gravity pulling on all the galaxies mutually would kind of slow everything down. Then we got the distances to these supernovae, and by we, I mean my advisors and collaborators that are, you know, sort of a generation before me. I was, you know, in high school when this was going on. They realized that the distances to these supernovae did not match the rest of what we knew about cosmology and the history of the universe. And so they went through all these explanations, and the one explanation they came up with that seemed to fit everything we knew was that the universe's expansion was actually accelerating. It was going faster and faster all the time.
Almost like you have your foot on like the accelerator of your car. Like not only are you maintaining your constant speed, say 60 miles per hour, but you're like putting the pedal to the metal and you're just going faster and faster. Is that right?
That's right.
Acceleration.
This expansion is accelerating. Yeah.
Yes.
The speed of the expansion is getting faster and faster with time. And this is counter to gravity. This is the exact opposite effect of gravity. So there's something pervading the universe that is pushing against gravity and winning on the biggest scales of the entire universe. And so astronomers have termed this dark energy. And we don't know too much about it. We know, like I said, it makes up about 3/4 of all the mass and energy in the universe, but we don't know too much more. And at first, you know, most other astronomers outside of the supernova field were like, these guys are doing something funny, this can't be right. But since then, many other subfields of astronomy totally unrelated to supernovae have not only detected the dark energy in the accelerating universe, but have confirmed that the amount of acceleration, the speeds, are very self-consistent with supernova. So we were probably the first group of astronomers to figure it out, but it's been confirmed many different ways, and we still have a lot of open questions about what it is, how it works.
So as a cosmology noob, I have a question. Is it hypothesized that the universe will eventually stop accelerating? Will it decelerate?
So that's a great question. The universe was actually decelerating for the first few billion years, few to 9 billion years. I forget that number off the top of my head. I apologize to all my supernova friends listening. But for a while, the universe was decelerating, just like we would expect from gravity, just like Newton would have told us if he had known the universe was expanding. Then at some point, the gravity force got diluted enough in the big universe that the dark energy force became stronger and started accelerating the expansion at that point. And we think all of the models currently seem to indicate that the universe's expansion will continue to accelerate forever. We think it had that one change from slowing down to speeding up a few billion years ago, and it's going to keep speeding up forever.
And then, so the universe will be here forever?
We think the universe will be here forever. That is the current models, yep.
But it's just going to be so cold. Everything's going to be so distant and far away from everything else.
Seems it'll bleak.
It'll be very bleak, yeah.
It will be bleak. The night sky will not have all these many pretty galaxies that we can see in our telescopes anymore.
Well, good. We have a few moments left. I wanted to ask you about one of the public outreach programs that you've been involved with and that you've really kickstarted here in Austin, and that's specifically the West Cave Preserve. Can you tell us a little bit about the program that you're running out there now?
So the West Cave Preserve is a great regional park about 45 or so minutes west of Austin. And I sort of stumbled across this program that they've been doing for quite a while, unbeknownst to, as far as I could tell, most of the astronomers at UT, where once a month they have public free star parties. Public inexpensive star parties. And, you know, they get groups of sort of 30 to 40 people, families, people of all ages. It's a great dark site. You're, you know, just enough outside of town where it is very dark. You can see the Milky Way with your naked eyes on a clear summer night, no problem. And they have a few dedicated amateur astronomers that pull out some very, very nice telescopes once a month to do some observing. And when I found out about this, I contacted them and said, you know, this is great stuff. I love what you're doing. Would you be interested in having some UT astronomers come out and support this by giving, you know, just a little talk on an interesting astronomy topic or their research or, you know, a little bit more of the science about what they're going to see that night? And they were really excited about it. And so a couple months ago, I went out and gave a little talk on some interesting objects that were going to be up in the night sky that night, and then everybody went outside and looked through the telescopes. Just this past Saturday, we had a UT astronomy grad student go out there, and even though it was all kinds of stormy and gross out, he still gave a couple of little talks to a dedicated group of about 15 people or so. And so we've connected the UT astronomers with the West Cave Preserve folks and these amateur astronomers out there. And I hope this continues. We've got the next 2 months we have lined up people to speak, and hopefully that'll continue into the future. And it's a great thing if you're in the area. It's a really neat event.
Cool. Yeah. In fact, in the next couple months, two of our friends and colleagues will be giving some really interesting talks. So that sounds great. I think we're about out of time. I wanted to mention one more thing.
Wait, did we get...
DJ name. So we usually require that our guest has a DJ name, so you can think about it as I announce this very exciting new big news that we have for our show, which is that we're now podcasting the show. You can go on iTunes or whatever and basically find our show and basically just search for They Blinded Me with Science and you'll find it, or KVRX Science, whatever. And so this very podcast will be on there within a few days. DJ name?
All right. So there's a little bit of backstory. I'll try to get through it quick. One of the first big papers that I was on as a grad student was about a new kind of supernova. This was back at Berkeley. A lot of people at UT have been thinking about these too. And they ended up being called superluminous supernovae, some of the brightest, most powerful supernovae in the universe. But an early draft of the paper, I tried to coin the term super duper nova. And for my supernova friends out there, this was 06GY with Nathan Smith and Alex Filipenko. I tried to get super duper nova into the paper. It didn't work. They thought superluminous sounded more official. So I'm going to use this as my DJ name, and I'll be DJ Super Duper Nova.
DJ Super Duper Nova. Thank you.
And tune in next week, 8:30 p.m. We'll be interviewing Alejandro Berrio, who's a student in integrative biology. And I think he'll be talking about coffee. Mm. So maybe the science of coffee. So... thanks for joining us this week, Jeff.
Thank you very much.